Welcome to Nature Knows, conversations with wild warriors and change makers. I'm your host, Jen Vitanzo, and this podcast is all about nature, both the wild kind outside our front doors and the humankind written within our DNA. Each episode showcases an individual who has dedicated their efforts to create a better today to ensure we have an actual tomorrow, and they are using their unique creative fingerprints to do it. These are the wild warriors and change makers constructing the bridges necessary to connect us all, human to human, species to species, worlds to worlds. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Nature Knows. Today's guest is Hannah Arnhold, who is a PhD student in ocean engineering at the University of New Hampshire. The conversation runs the gamut from stuff like diving with sharks to building fish robots. So we're just going to dive right on in. Okay, so we're here today with Hannah Arnhold, who is an ocean engineer, or is studying to be an ocean engineer. You're a PhD student right now. We're going to just discuss a little bit about what you do and get some background and some stories about how you got to where you are, areas of interest, etc. So I'm going to leave it up to you to talk about your sort of journey. So have at it.
So just to start at where I am right now, you already said I'm a PhD, studying to be a PhD in ocean engineering. I'm currently at the University of New Hampshire and in my second semester. So COVID hit at a great time right when I started. So, but we're working on research. We've converted everything over to do everything at home. So we're making do with the situation. But I'm pretty fresh in the major and learning all the things now. But it's awesome so far. Before pursuing the PhD, I was in industry for 2 years as a systems engineer in the defense industry. And before that, I was at the University of Miami getting my bachelor's in science in mechanical engineering. I have a minor in marine policy as well, so the ocean's kind of been following me through my education. I also was equipment manager for the University of Miami Scuba Club, so I was in the water during my undergrad. Hard not to be when you're in Miami. So I've always had a chance to play through coral reefs and be on the water. And leading into that, I'm from Long Island, New York. Always grew up on the water, always was interested in sea life and everything out there. So I'm just glad that I followed that kind of dream all the way to where I am now. So it's pretty nice.
Cool. So what kind of, like, with doing the PhD stuff, what kind of work, like specific project, can you talk about that stuff? I don't know.
A little bit. We're still trying to figure out my dissertation topic and getting that nailed down. And as a stereotypical PhD, I've been putting that off and trying to figure it out. I have a little bit of writer's block, but I'm figuring it out. But just to jumpstart my research, we're following an Instructables link to build a robotic out of PVC. So it's completely open source. So if you want to do it yourself, it's out there. It's just a lot of work.
That's really cool.
I only have a tail done so far, but it's coming along. We were hoping to have it done by the end of the summer, but it's coming along, for sure.
So with regards to that kind of stuff, how much, I studied biomimicry.
We're doing biomimetic. So
okay.
Biomimetic robotic fish. So okay. I usually just say robotic fish because no one knows what biomimetic is. I didn't even know what biomimetic was until like this past year. So
can you explain a little bit about it? I was just talking to, just to like let people just,
biomimetic is just taking like something like a robot, right, which is inherently unnatural, and making it mimic nature. So essentially, if I'm building a robot fish, we're hoping that it actually acts like a fish, and then the fish in nature take it in as one of their own, and it just blends in, and it's pretty much a regular fish instead of a robot. So
nice.
We had a few things like that in the bush where you'd have a bird that was a robot essentially with a camera to put in with other or different random animals that they'd essentially build the body like the body in how it would be in nature, the animal it would be in nature, but they'd fit a little camera to it and they'd have it running around with all the other animals. And it was really interesting because occasionally, you know, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. Some animals would be like, this is not, because it didn't smell quite right. And then they would be doing things like putting the scent of urine on things that were like cats or dogs, you know, things that would normally use spray, like scent marking and stuff. Some of them were hilarious. And some of them, you knew the animals were looking at it like, what were you thinking? Like that, what, that's not even close, you know?
Yeah, we're hoping to apply it at least at first in aquaculture with steelhead trout. So hopefully trout aren't as picky about their friends.
Aquapets.
Yeah.
That's cool. With regards to the ocean stuff, that this is essentially sort of like, I grew up at the Jersey Shore, so I totally get it. I was always an ocean kid myself, and then was out in California. So when I moved to South Africa and was like in the middle of the bush, I was like, this is so strange. There's a lot of dunes and there's no ocean. I used to scuba dive, but I really officially got my scuba certification about 2 years ago and found out a really cool thing, which is when you cut yourself underwater, it looks green instead of red. Pretty red. Yeah. Everyone's like, yeah, because there's no, like, you don't have the oxygenation of the air like you do in the, you know.
Well, it's not just that. So the color spectrum, the deeper you go, the less it travels. So colors are like a frequency of light. So the red frequencies can't make it as deep as, say, like blue or purple.
Right.
So that's why your blood will appear green underwater instead, because red literally can't make it down there. Yeah. Well, that's why. So with underwater photography, you need a strobe to bring that light back. So usually, like you see scuba divers with these huge lights on their camera rigs, just to bring all those colors back to life, even when you're 100 feet down.
Right.
So it's pretty cool science.
Yeah. There's a really, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's a really cool series called Tales by Light. And I think it's a Netflix series, and they're short. They're like 20-minute segments. And it's photographers in different capacities, like in the field doing different types of photography. But there's a guy who's an underwater photographer, and he was doing a shipwreck, and it was so wild. Like exactly that, the huge strobes. But getting all the lighting, because he was doing nighttime photography, which when you're in deep water, it's kind of always nighttime photography to a degree. But it was wild the way he had to set up all the lights. And he was talking about exactly that. It's like you don't have the full spectrum, which is why you also don't see certain colors at certain depths, which is pretty cool. Yeah. It's like,
when you watch James Cameron's footage down in the Mariana Trench or off the Titanic, they have huge LEDs off their submersibles to get all of that color back for their footage.
Right.
So it's a lot of work, it's a lot of equipment, a lot of weight. Very advanced stuff. So definitely not for the beginner diver.
The weight's enough. Just trying to carry around the tanks and everything.
It's so hard. Especially if you're doing a shore dive instead of a boat dive, and you have to like, especially up here when most of you, like the shores you're diving off of are rocky beaches.
Yep.
And you're like trying to slide down without falling and lugging your tents and your dry suits. It's a lot.
I feel like I have quarantine. Are you suffering from quarantine brain? I'm suffering from quarantine brain.
Yeah, especially with getting back into school and all that starting, like having to put real jeans on again instead of living in pajama pants and leggings. You're just like, how do I leave the house and be a human again?
Right.
So.
My hair was super short when I first moved back from South Africa, and I just let it grow because I was like putting it back in. I love to put it in a ponytail. It's just easier. And when you're on the bush, it's just all you do. Like, I don't think I ever had my hair down when I lived there. But I was just thinking about the other day, I was like, I should, you know, maybe get it cut. Like all kinds of things. And I was like, I don't remember how to put makeup on. I had to wear heels for something the other day. And I was like, oh no. No. Why do we do this to ourselves? Like, it was so much. Why?
I decided to wear like a little bootlet to campus on Monday. And they have like an inch or two heel on them. And I was super comfortable in them before quarantine. And I think I gave myself shin splints.
Oh, yeah.
Wearing them across campus, especially since UNH is a hilly campus. And yeah, I'm just sticking to sneakers for now.
Right.
So
I get it. Oh man. So when you're out, essentially when you're all done, sort of what is your sort of end goal, or is it sort of still amorphous? Are you still working through that?
I'm still working through it, especially since I just came from a full-time job.
Yeah.
I don't want to block off the opportunities of going back into defense, but I'd like to see myself somewhere else in industry, maybe, or even in academia. We'll see how much I like my classes going forward and maybe helping grading and how that goes. But still feeling my way through, especially since I'm only in my second semester. So I still have about like 4-ish years to figure it out. So. But UNH is heavily involved with NOAA.
Right.
Was it the National
Oceanic Atmospheric?
Yeah. They actually have a satellite office like right in the Ocean Engineering building. So who knows? Maybe I'll end up there. There's a lot of opportunities. So
you should let me know. I have a friend who's with NASA that does a lot of stuff with them, and he works polar mostly. Like he's constantly. He just looks constantly uncomfortable in very thick, fluffy, poofy clothes because he's. I always see him in pictures of like, on 10 feet of ice, and but yeah, he does a lot of stuff with that. So definitely let me know. Like I'll see if I can connect the two of you if you're interested in that.
Okay.
But that's just sort of fascinating. It's always really interesting talking to people about climate versus weather because there's a lot of people that think they're one and the same, and it's like, well, no, they're two very separate things.
Well, because when people think global warming and then ice horrible winter dumps on us, like the warming isn't existing, like it's not there, but it is because climate change is a thing, and that's why the weather patterns are off, and we're getting drenchos in the Midwest, double hurricanes in the Gulf.
Yeah.
Like
it's crazy.
Insane.
Yep. Like it's flipping. It's almost like it's flipping. Like places that were previously, well, some places that were dry are getting super dry. But then there's other places that seem like they were drier that are getting a lot wetter, and places that were wetter that are getting a lot drier too. It's just
even up here in New England, it's almost becoming like a tropical climate. Like I think I saw something about New York being considered a tropical climate now. And growing up in New York or even New Jersey, like, would you have ever guessed it was a tropical climate? Especially when you're downtown in Manhattan and you walk out of a building in like the middle of winter and the cold wind hits your face.
Oh yeah.
Want to run back inside.
Yeah.
So.
And Nicole, New York is, I always joke about it because it's like the rest, you get, as soon as you get outside of the city, it's like it warms up 10 or 15 degrees.
Yeah.
Just because the buildings are so tall that you never see the sun. And you just have these canyons, literally canyons of buildings that the wind will just come down and it's bitter. It's just bitter cold. Okay, so your industry, traditionally not known for having a lot of women. I'm guessing. How has that been? Like how, is that something you have to struggle, like deal with a lot?
It's like up and down. I haven't personally really had to deal with a horrible situation, knock on wood yet. But you hear about them. I was lucky in the defense industry and worked in an area where it was mostly women, a lot of women in leadership. So I've gotten to have some good examples of kind of what to do in industry, how to act with everyone, how to just be equal with everyone and know that as a norm. But right now I'm in a class and the professor's a male, everyone else in the class is a male. I'm just there doing the same thing. So you just have to get used to being the only girl and not let it affect you. The other thing was also still making sure you're comfortable and happy and that you do have your girlfriends when you want them. Like, I actively seeked out female friendship by joining a sorority during my undergrad, which was also a lot balancing with engineering. But I it made me happy. There were other girls in my sorority who were in engineering, just different kinds. And we were like our own little community. There's also organizations like the Society of Women Engineers, or SWE,
right.
Where we all get together, network, learn how, like job building advice, mentorship, just a lot of support from women in the industry out there. I think, what was it called? There's like Women in Defense also, which I got to go to a meeting or two for. So again, the defense industry, you would think it would be a lot of women, but there's still a decent amount of women out there too. So
that's awesome.
It's not just that whole gung-ho like army vision of like guys fighting each other. No, there's women there too.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's the thing. Like one of the, we talked about this before, like one of the things that I found really important is showing sort of the showing people in these careers that we have such an image of, and it has been like previously, traditionally it had been very male dominated. And but there were always women involved. Like if you saw Hidden Figures when it came out, it's like, wait, there were women sending people to the moon, and not only women, but people, women of color. And like there have been women involved in like Ada Lovelace and like so many people that historically, or so many women who historically have made huge impacts in the engineering realm, the scientific realm, the, just across the board. And you just, again, we've consistently seen in media and whatever these portrayals that it's always men. And so I'm really glad to hear that there are a lot more women out there. And obviously your class being one situation, but I know now it's amazing. I keep talking to people and I keep finding more and more women in engineering. And I'm like this, and my niece is actually studying, she was studying engineering at UVA. And I was like, this is awesome because it's good to see the representation that there are other people, because it's not just that each person is different and unique, but also that different, you know, it's just different perspectives on things. And if you just have the same thing, the same, like just a white male doing everything, I feel like you're silencing a lot of, not even necessarily meaning to, but you're missing out on all these other voices and insights that they don't have just by virtue of that, you know? So.
So yeah, like you were saying, it's the media, especially in the 50s, 60s, most of the leadership on those projects would technically be male, and the women would kind of get pushed over because women don't do science, women don't do engineering. So at least nowadays, there's a lot more women in leadership to make sure that those memes come out. They're equally shown to their peers. So if a man and a woman are equally working on a project together, it's not just the man who's getting the credit, it's the woman too.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky enough, like my advisor is a woman. There's a few other people under my advisor. There's a few of us who are girls. So it's kind of nice that we have our own little community, and you're seeing like most, like more of these role models that are women.
Right. Because that is so important when you're, you know, going into a career or just interested in something, but nobody looks like you. It's hard to feel, because you kind of feel like you just subconsciously, it's like you just feel like you don't have a place there. It's like, well, I don't really belong, even though maybe no one is even saying it to you. It's just when you don't get to see a reflection of yourself, it is hard to feel like you just instinctively feel like something's missing and maybe this isn't where I should be, just because you're not there. You know, there's no counterpart to you there that you can say, oh, I can do this because they did it. Like it's constantly feeling like you're blazing your own trail, which you are anyway, but you know, it's nice to know that you're not the only one.
And I think the most important part, especially when you're going to a field where there's not a lot of women, is just knowing like what you want, what your goals are, where you see yourself.
Right.
Because if you can get to that point, then you can do it in real life every day. Even if you're the only woman there, like if you're like, I'm going to do this and I want to be here and do that, then you won't let anyone talk you down, or you hopefully won't feel bad about it.
Right.
Because you have that ultimate. So just follow your dream. So.
Do you have a favorite thing that you are a favorite? So is there a favorite sort of project that you've worked on or something that you really enjoyed working on?
I guess it's not as much of working on, but I got to do a study abroad with Broadreach a few years ago to Fiji to study shark biology and conservation. We got to go to Benga Lagoon, which is on the main island in Fiji, and dive with the Benga Adventure Divers. They're known as BAD, so the Bad Boys. We got to go to the Shark Reef Marine Reserve, which they're the only dive charter that can go there. And every time you watch Shark Week, when you see your friendly bull sharks on there, a lot of the time they film there. And we got to see, I think, up to like 80 bull sharks at once.
Oh my gosh.
No cage, 90 feet dive. And it was just awesome. We would do about a dive a day, minus like maybe once or twice a week for 3 weeks. And then we also got to be there with a dive instructor. So if someone went without their advanced certification, they could get it there.
Right.
And then we also had a professor with us, and she was teaching us about the shark biology and conservation. And we got to actually do a behavioral project with the sharks. So we had to choose something to like observe how they react to it. So my buddy and I, we took, there's these big for diving, and it had bees in it, and they're underwater to get other divers. But we were like, what if we do this and the sharks turn around? So we were trying to see how that works out. And unfortunately, due to like our statistical model, and we didn't have as much data as we wanted, it was found to be insignificant. But hey, my dive buddy and I noticed that they would turn around most of the time. So we actually got to like do that. It wasn't really an engineering project. We kind of made it more sciencey with the statistics, but overall it was just fun. It was different. I used that for my marine affairs minor. So it was a fun time, and it was an experience I'll never forget. And I'm itching to get back to Fiji at some point.
That's so cool. Bull sharks are not there. They're I think they're the only shark I'm really actually scared of.
They're very cuddly when they're well fed.
Yeah.
And not trying to hunt you.
Yeah. They're cool. I've just found them super unpredictable. But then again, I've never been in a situation where they've necessarily been well fed.
I did my research before going, and I was like, I'm not going if they've had an incident. Like, bull sharks are the most aggressive species of shark. Like, I'm not going to mess around with this. And that dive charter has never had an incident. At least, again, knock on wood. When I went in 2016, they didn't. So they have a lot of safety protocols. And honestly, at the end of the day, the sharks get to know them.
Yeah.
There was actually a tiger shark that would occasionally come through, and she knew the specific diver that would be with her because they would hunt her. And I just remember them telling this story where I think it was the two owners of the dive shop. One would always wear a yellow hood, so like a European hood that goes over your head, and the other owner would wear a black one. And the yellow hood would be the one who would feed the tiger shark. So one day they were like, okay, let's switch hoods. He's going to go to whoever's wearing the yellow one, obviously. Like, yellow means food. No, she was the guy who normally feeds her. So sharks really do have this intelligence that no one really thinks they do. And once you build a relationship with them, they don't really want to eat you as much. So, and they never really want you to begin with. They think you're probably a seal coming on the surface.
I've been in the water with sharks. I don't know how many times with great whites. I've been Cape Town is known notoriously for great whites, but they have these gully sharks, and they're really neat. I don't know if there's another name for them or if it's a South African thing, but the gully sharks grow to about 6 or 8 feet, and they swim in the kelp forest. And the kelp, and that's where they sort of have their nurseries. But the kelp forests, as opposed to some other areas of the kelp forests, are further offshore. These are literally like you get into the water and it's right there. And so you're in like 6 feet of water, or, you know, maybe up to 20 feet max. And you're just swimming right around with them and like through the kelp with them. And they're just so chill. And I mean, I'm sure if they got aggravated that they might turn around and, you know, bite because they got aggravated, which like anything would do. But yeah, I've always been fascinated because like they have such, sharks have such a bad rep of being like these just cold killers. And there's so many stories that are starting to come out now with just, and because they're in the water, and it's obviously it's a harder substrate essentially to study because it's not our natural, you have to have a breathing apparatus, you know, or be an amazing free diver, but even still you're limited. It's not our natural state of being, like the water's so foreign to us in so many ways, and it's big, like the ocean's huge. So tracking an animal that can, you know, swim 2,000 miles is a bit harder to study than something that's like in your backyard, you know? So,
well, that's kind of what we're hoping to do with the biomimetic.
Yeah.
Eventually, at some point, I'm hoping that I can get like a different type of and then get it into open water, open ocean. And I'd love to start at some point. I've even been joking about like remora bot. I think someone did it already, but like that would be a perfect way to latch onto a great white.
Right.
If you're remora, I see them. And you just get it into your eyes.
How cool would that be? You just have video of swimming with a great white for literally like 2,500 miles.
And I mean, there's Shark Cam. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah.
Through Woods Hole. So they like re-outfitted, I think it's a torpedo and it has a camera on it. And it's awesome. But then the shark figures out something's following it. And then it comes up and bites it every time.
Right.
And it's just like, what's this thing following me? I don't like it. I'm going to try to kill it. And so at least if you come up with something that aligns with its normal day-to-day behavior, like a remora, then you could follow it, hopefully, for way longer than shark can.
Right. Yeah. And that makes sense. And that's, I guess, where a lot of the biomimicry stuff also comes in. It's understanding the behavior and their natural state of being and building something that fits is in line with that so that it isn't something that's unnatural. So it isn't something they're going to turn around and be like, why are you still here? Like the way we would if something was following us, like, why are you still here? What are you?
Yeah.
But if it's like a remora, which normally they have a little remora swimming along with them, it wouldn't even necessarily, you know, register that it's not supposed to be there, you know, or not, not a normal remora. That's really cool. Yeah, sharks are, great whites are actually my favorite animals. Just always been fascinated by sharks in general. I don't know if that's a Jersey thing just because of the whole Jaws thing, but I don't, like in a weird, bizarre twist of fate that I like the crazy stories that should have made me terrified of the water or made me love the water.
Well, like Peter eventually totally regrets how Jaws went. Like he came up with that, well, actually, he wrote that book, Shark Trouble, if you've read that. So he turned to nonfiction, wrote this whole thing about everything else in the ocean that could kill you other than a shark.
Right.
It really made me hate dolphins after.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
But the man who created this whole empire about sharks that kill, turned around and was like, they're not mindless murderers. Don't hand on sharks.
Yeah, he's like the biggest proponent now for protecting sharks. And
I read that back in high school. And I also read Jaws in high school. And also growing up on Long Island, if you read the book Jaws, they mention the Hamptons a ton. So it really hit close to home for me. But it still didn't really change anything with sharks at that point.
And I think it just made me sort of fascinated, like, wow, these things are incredible. Like, I just want to understand them because they're so different. It's like people have a natural fear of snakes because, again, I think they're so different. It's so foreign. You know, it's they're theoretically cold. Well, I guess not all sharks, though, are technically cold-blooded, which is, I guess, a new development they found.
Yeah, they have different kinds of muscles. So they have white muscle or red muscle. I forgot which one does which. But one of them ends up creating enough energy to heat them. So I want to say like great whites maybe
can regulate their body temperature. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's pretty crazy that they can do that.
Yeah. It's so great. It's all, stuff is wild. It's amazing. I just think it's so cool. I just nerd out on this all the time. So what are like next steps for you? You're finishing up. Well, so So this has got to be crazy, though, for you guys going back to school with all of this. How is that?
Yeah. Especially since, like I said, it's only my second semester back. Last semester was a little easy, too. I had a TA, which wasn't easy, but my class load was a little lighter. We kind of hit for the minimum because my advisor didn't want me to see myself failing out of all my classes. So it was like a nice segue from being 2 years out of college back into college. But this is my, like, first semester taking stuff like acoustics, graduate differential equations, and this waves and tides class. So a lot of physics, a lot of math. Two of the classes I'm taking online, they are being taught in class, but the professors are either kind of pre-recording or doing it live on Zoom. Right in the class, and you have to write the notes like you would. So it's not that different. And then one class I have to go in for, but it's all graduate students. It's like eight people and the professor. So it's under 10 at least. And it's like any other class, but everyone's kind of spaced out and you're wearing a mask for a long time. So
different.
Yeah, it's surreal. I had to go today, this morning, to drop something off. And the commuter parking lot, which is normally filled by 9:30, when I got there at 9:30, it was half empty. Wow. So it's just people are on campus, but not around.
Not around, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a different time. Like, this is just such an unusual year on so many levels.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. Do you find that? So, I mean, I always joke at the top that joke that I'm the type of person that has to like pee on the electric fence to figure out how it works. Like, some people are really good at book learning. Some people are really good. Like, they need to be hands-on. They need to be, like you were saying before, that you like getting your hands dirty and like getting involved in it. Do you find, like, with what you're doing, do you find that there's a specific learning style that's really helped you?
It's so definitely like peeing on the electric fence. especially since I haven't been in school for a few years, so it's like figuring out what works for me. I love taking and I take them all on an iPad. And I handwrite them. Like, I got undergrad, I used just a regular stylus. I have an Apple pencil now. But with the note and then just solving problems, I usually figure it out fine. Well, that's undergrad. Like, technically, this isn't saying you shouldn't go, but sometimes you don't even need the lectures because you would just read it in the textbook and figure it out yourself.
Right.
So it may apply this way still. I don't know these professors' teaching styles. They all seem very interactive, though, and write on the board and don't just regurgitate a PowerPoint.
Right.
So at least my notes will be live instead of from a textbook. So it's really just adapting. And luckily, it's the way they're formatting it isn't just like any online course. They're still in class and writing on a whiteboard. So it's like if you were there, you'd be doing the same with notes.
Right.
And I try to like make sure I watch all the videos live so that way I'm not procrastinating. I'm putting them off and it's still in my like little schedule. So.
And do you have labs that go along with all of this stuff?
Luckily, this semester, we decided to put off any classes with labs until probably next year. So that way, if we all go virtual, I don't have to worry about it. And that's one less class I'd have to go like into class for.
Exactly.
But I think I do have at least one or two classes in the PhD requirements where I'll need labs. UNH does have some other labs, though, like the Shoals Marine Lab, which... per my project, I may actually get to visit. No guarantees, but I'll let you know if we do get to go. But that's a lot of marine biology research there, so we might be able to see some fishy friends. But that's not part of a class, that's more for research.
Right. Yeah, so I'm realizing that nerding out at a museum, this is a while back, but like I said, I love biology. I love sciences. I'm terrible at them, like in terms of studying and like being research. And I just don't have the proclivity to sit still.
Yeah.
Like doing a lot of the stuff with research, you got to just sit for hours on end and do like and study and like watch. And I'm like, no, no, like I said, I have to be doing stuff. So I was always really good at taking the stuff that people had worked on and then turning it into general conversation pieces that anyone could understand. But with regards to the ocean, I didn't realize like there are so many different, so you have your tidal zones, you have your deep water zones and like the trench mm-hmm. zones, and you have all these different areas oceanographically with regards to like different pHs, different this, like all kinds of different stuff. So with your stuff, you're looking, you're specifically ocean. So you're looking seawater essentially, not necessarily lakes and things.
Yeah. And especially with aquaculture, most of like current aquaculture is going towards deeper waters.
Right.
But it's usually in a controlled environment called an aquapen. I think that's what it's called. And like with trout, that one's floating on the surface. So really like the main thing would be current. So if there's a heavy current coming through that pen, then if our little robot fish is in there, we don't want it to be pushed against the wall of the pen. We want it swimming with the other trout.
Right.
So things like that are going to have to be considered for sure, but that's way down the line. The first priority is making the fish, making sure it swims in like a fish tank, or UNH has a huge acoustics tank. I think it's 20 by 20 feet or maybe 30 by 30, and they're like 15, 20 feet deep.
Right.
They actually do scuba classes in there, I think, sometimes. So at least the Ocean Engineering School has that resource too. And since campus is open again, that's open again. So if I do get a working model, I might have to tie some fishing line to it and see if it'll swim around the tank.
But. You guys should see if you can get involved with a like Boston Aquarium or one of the aquariums about getting in the tanks. And
that's been a running joke because I have an undergraduate that works with me, and she's doing a semester in Boston. Yeah. And my advisor's been joking around like don't take a photo at the aquarium and say this is your robot fish. Well, no. So
no, but you guys should test them because I know you can like they have. These are the divers that are in there that are feeding the fish, that are cleaning the tanks and whatever. It's like, well, you got to test out your fish, and this is a controlled environment.
Yeah, and I mean, UNH has labs for fish, so we'll hopefully get to that point where in a controlled area too, once without fish it works, we'll try to test it with fish before throwing it into the ocean and possibly losing it forever.
It's like the joke with Jaws, the movie Jaws. Do you know the whole history with the shark when they were trying to make the shark for the movie?
Was his name Bruce, or is that just?
Yes, it was Bruce.
Okay.
But like they made like three different versions, and it was just every single one of them just sank, or it just would get stuck, or it was like one engineering nightmare after another, like robotic nightmare.
And it's like the cheesiest looking robotic shark.
Yes.
Like very 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Very.
And the reason you didn't see the shark at all for the first half of the movie was basically because they couldn't get the thing to work, which ended up working to its favor because it makes it more suspenseful. You know, you never get to see it. You just hear the music. It's like inferred. But yeah, it was basically because they couldn't get the thing to work. So, but it's just there's so many things, like so many factors that you talk about, like with biomimicry. When you're talking about a fish, you have swim bladders that you've got to take into consideration. You have weight variations with a swim bladder would change the weight and like the percentage of whatever. Like my fish biology is not that great, but so when they're swimming with what is in the swim bladder? Like what do they? Is it actually oxygen? Is it nitrogen?
I think it's a combination of like air, natural oils. I haven't read up on it in a really long time. I used to know definitely at some point, but I don't fully remember. I do know that this robot fish, though, the instructables link does instruct you to make a like at-home ballast tank. So I have these like huge like plastic rubber syringes that without the like almost what you use for food.
Right.
And you put like little CO2 canisters on too, and it sucks in water and put them out. So we'll see how that works.
Oh, that's so crazy.
But I'll have to be building one of those too. But it's definitely important to consider because A, you don't want your robot, B, you don't want it anywhere.
Right.
And you want it in the water column where right. you want it. So that's definitely something you'd want to control.
Yeah. It's amazing. Like so many things that I think you realize when things that seem so simple, and then when you get into it and you realize like what these things do naturally, how incredible their engineering is. Like our engineering as a human being and our systems, it's so many little bits and pieces that work together so perfectly to make everything function. It's like, when you think about it, you're like, oh, we'll just build a fish and let it swim. And it's like, ah, but the real fish has all of these different dynamics that are working together and all these little systems that are working together. And it is like it's a feat of engineering, like all these different pieces that are part of this puzzle, and they all like work in tandem and do all these different things and are like a series of levees and this and whatever, and like pulleys, and they're letting this air out here and bringing air in here, or they're pushing this through their system, and the way gills work, and like so many different little bits of engineering that are, it's just fascinating. Like even the skin, like even the scales are crazy. Like sharks, I'm guessing that's probably one of the things that you guys, shark skin.
How it's teeth. They have tiny hundreds of teeth on their skin.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I remember reading something about Boeing when I worked on I wrote a kid's book about a praying mantis that I raised, and I remember like studying up on praying mantises and the biomimicry, because I was actually taking a class on it at the time. And they were talking how Boeing and other aerospace companies were actually looking into how the Uthaka, the egg casings, were made, because they're temperature controlled and they withstand a lot of pressure in terms of like whatever, if they get hit by something, so they can keep their structural integrity. And they were basically studying the egg casings to figure out how to make insulation that was really lightweight, that was also very good at keeping temperature or controlling the temperature, but also the humidity levels and everything. I was like, that's insane.
Well, it's the same thing going back to the torpedo. A torpedo shape stems from fish and sharks.
Right.
Like it's that hydrodynamic shape. Same thing with cars.
Yep.
Like you need to get something that flows through this the best way you can. And why not get it from nature? Because that's already doing it.
Right? That's really cool. So, okay. So we're at about an hour and I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But if you had a bit of advice for anybody going into your field, what would you... Or any advice. You can have lots of advice.
So I'd say if you're already in industry and you're not happy with what you're doing, either talk to someone about it, like a section manager, and say, okay, maybe I want to try something different, or B, figure out what you actually want to do. Like I wanted to go follow my PhD route and go do it. So don't be scared to do that. Find lots of mentors. Mentorship is always important. I've luckily gotten to have a few since high school. One of which was my mom's best friend from high school. And they've helped me a ton, especially with engineering questions. And finding those, they've all been women for the most part. So at least getting that role model who looks like you to make sure you know where to go. I have something else written down.
Are there specific skills that you have found that people might not think of when they think of engineering that you found have been really useful?
I'd say communicating. Everyone thinks engineers are these like nerdy stereotypes. I'm happy I got to go to the University of Miami. Because our engineering program was anything but that. We're all very social people.
So don't be afraid to be a human.
You're not just a calculator. If you want to be an engineer, you're still a person.
Yeah. Yeah, I found communication is like the number one in every field, because you realize like we're social animals. We need to talk to each other. We need to communicate. Like that's the basis of how we work. And I think so many people are like, oh, I don't have to learn how to do that. I don't really need to learn how to talk to people, or I don't need to. And I get it, because, you know, introverts versus extroverts, like extroverts thrive on chatting away and being involved with people, and introverts are like, yeah, little bits and pieces, and then I need to step away. But like, it is so important to be able to work on who you are and find whatever capacity works for you, but still be able to, because none of us work in a vacuum, right? None of us exist in a vacuum. So I always feel like just find a way to cultivate, even if you're not out there all the time, because I couldn't do that. Like, as I was, even as a performer, I would be toast by the time I was done with the tour. I'd sleep for like a month because it was constantly having to talk to people like all day. And you'd be happy all the time. And I was like, oh, no. And I would be exhausted. And at the end of the day, I'd be done with the show. And then everyone wants to talk to you. And I'm like, oh, I just want to go to bed. But you just find ways and you figure it out. But then you just take your time and build things in. I feel like you build checks and balances in to make sure that you're doing yourself a service for who you are as a person, but also remembering that you're part of the bigger picture kind of thing. Like, how do you work within that, navigating within that?
Yeah.
Did you find
and I
that
think,
down?
Oh, and oh, sorry, I think no, the no, other, no, just no, like to go off that, though, so, the other big thing with engineering that people don't realize is it's a group activity. So if you can't work with other people, then engineering is going to be really tough, especially if you're thinking of doing that for a degree. I would not have survived my program without my friends. We would be studying until 3 a.m. together, but we really helped each other out. There were a lot of group projects. And then in an industry, that's just a reflection of that. We're always working in teams. You're never really alone. Maybe you'll have your like few assignments on yourself, but you always come back to the main group and kind of rediscuss everything. So knowing A, how to be a person, and then B, interacting with people on a regular basis. Not as much as showing and being a musician and going off and having to always talk. You still have your moments alone, but you just have to know how to go from one to the other and back and forth.
And do you find, I know that there's sort of, I think there's always been this preconception and sort of misconception that if you're creative, you can only be in certain careers if you're creative, and that certain careers are not creative at all, or like if you're in math, you're just because you're not a creative person. And I don't think that's true at all. I think creativity is in everything, and everybody has creativity within them. Even if it's like, well, because creativity, in my opinion, has always been about problem solving and a natural curiosity about the world and like understanding how things work. And it's just like, that's what the arts are, really. It's, you know, you see something and you want to understand why it is the way it is, and you work through it, and you might work through it in a capacity that's painting versus building a fish to follow the fish. But it's,
and I mean, you can do both.
Yeah.
Like, I come from a line of artists and musicians. My mom was a theater major. I'm connected to you guys
from music.
My aunt being a folk musician. My grandma was in theater as well. I love painting. I'm trying to pick up crocheting now. I mean, I was at a sorority. I was pretty crafty in college. So you can be artsy on your own, and then you can apply that talent to building a robotic fish. You have everything still. You can still be an artist, but you're still an engineer too. You don't have to put yourself in a box.
Right, but I feel like engineering is an art in and of itself too.
Like, any science is.
Yeah.
I think one of my favorite examples of it actually is biologists kind of playing with agar plates and like molding bacteria into art. Because that's still science, but that's actually physical art too.
Yeah.
And that's just showing nature's art also, how we're manipulating it into human art. But there's art everywhere. I guess that's why they might have lumped arts into STEM as you know, STEAM.
Right.
Because it is there, and it's not, again, it's not just a box. Like, yeah. Engineering is comprised of all of it. It's not just one thing or another. So.
Cool. Yeah, I would agree. I'm not an engineer, but I actually worked in engineering at one point, believe it or not. Not as an engineer, but as doing marketing writing and I had to learn so many things about torque. like all kinds of random, anyway, so much. But it was really interesting because, like, you know, I had no business, quote unquote, being involved in engineering because I didn't have an engineering background, but it was like a curiosity and learning how to communicate about it and talk to people about stuff and say, this is what's going on and this is how it works. And, you know, I'm always a big fan of telling people you can get involved in any industry. You might not get involved in the capacity you thought you would get involved in it in, or you might not have the right, maybe it's not the right word, but the ideal personality / skills / whatever for a certain job in that industry, but you can find a way in. Like,
yeah, and I mean, that's like one of the biggest things, especially women have issues with, is you need to apply to jobs you're not qualified for, because men do it all the time.
Right.
And they usually get it. So if you just try, the worst thing that happens is they say you didn't get the job.
Right.
But apply to everything, even if you don't think it works for you. Like, I just went through mechanical engineering. I didn't see myself in the defense industry, and I found myself there. So you never know what'll happen when you apply to 100 jobs. So.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's about just believing. You're like, I can do this. I can find a way to do it. And I again, even if you don't have every bit of the qualifications, you learn too. You learn on so many jobs. You learn on the job. And you have to have a willingness to be open to learning, right? And picking things up and just trying it, you know? And not being afraid to fail. That was always my biggest thing. It was, for a long time, it was a fear of failure. So it wasn't that I didn't try things. It was like I would kind of try things without telling people I was trying things, so that if I failed miserably, no one would actually know that I failed miserably except for me.
Well, sometimes the bravest thing you can do is you go full into something and then you figure out midway, like, either you can't do it or you don't want to do it. Like, you got yourself into a situation and you just realize, like, wait, I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And the bravest thing you can do is say, look, I'm not doing this. I don't think I'm actually qualified for this, or this isn't what I thought it would be.
Right.
So I'm going to leave and open up a space for someone more qualified or someone who really, really wants this.
Right.
And people look down on you, but sometimes they actually look higher at you because you could admit it.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I've left a ton of things where I've been like, this is just not for me. I mean, it was just not for me, as much as it was a great job or a great opportunity, but I was like, but this is not, it's not who I am as a person. It's not like, it's not using my skills and interests and personality to the max. And there's someone else that could do this better than I can. And so it's like, yes, I might've committed 4 or 5 years to it, but what, you know, and my attitude has always been, and maybe this isn't the right attitude, but I feel like it served me well. You learn in every capacity, you get something out of it always. And, you know, you might not realize you've gotten something out of it until years later, when suddenly you're in another position. You're like, oh my gosh, well, this is so similar to what I was doing 5 or 6 years ago in a totally different job, even in a different industry. And yet you can carry those skills and that experience over. So it's never like it's never a lost cause. It's never it was a failure. It's never like, I feel like failure is even the wrong word. I feel like it's just, sometimes things don't work out the way you thought they were going to work out. And
well, it's like when you put yourself on a path, then you just have blinders on and you go in one direction and you probably won't be happy.
Right.
But if you think of it more like a path with stepping stones and they can branch off and you end up in a totally different direction,
exactly,
then you'll live a happier life.
Yeah. Yeah. There isn't always a direct, usually there isn't a direct path. In fact, it's usually a lot of little circles kind of going around this way and a little weaving and...
Well, and I guess growing up in a family of mostly artists, that's all I know.
Yeah. And mine's the total opposite. My family is all like stockbroker, doctor, lawyer, like, here's your path and you go along it. But even still within that, you know, they haven't exactly deviated nearly as much as I have, but just very different. But still, there have, you know, I remember having a conversation with my older sister and she was like, this is not where I thought I was going to be. I'm like, that's okay. So just veer, you know? Pivot, whatever, change the sail, tack, jive, do something. But if you're not happy where you are, you know, you can always make changes. It doesn't, I think,
There's that phrase, when you make plans, God laughs at you.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a very religious person, but I've always, like, lived by that phrase. Because if you make rigid plans, and then it all goes south, and you're sad, then you just put blinders on, and you didn't account for any other scenarios.
Right.
So.
I joke all the time about that, because I'm, you know, I've had people who've been like, well, you know, you didn't get what you were going to get going after. I'm like, no, didn't work out quite the way I thought it was going to work out, but I just roll with it because you just have to. You just, what is your other option, right? It's like, you just roll with it and say, all right, make the best out of this. But yeah, like I've gone through a lot of my life and people are like, well, you're not a planner. I'm like, actually not true. Again, sometimes I just keep the plans to myself because when they go horribly wrong, then I don't have to like feel like I have to answer to somebody. But I always have a plan, but I used to have like super tight plans, being like, well, I have a 3-year plan, 5-year plan. This is what we're going to do. And this is how it's going to work. And it never did. Never did. There was always at least 1 or 20 things that would come in that would just screw everything up. And it was like Murphy's Law, that something, whatever can go wrong, will go wrong, no matter how well you plan it. And so it was just like, okay, well, I'm going to have an idea. I have a general idea. I have a few steps, and I'm going to have the adaptability to be able to change if these don't go, you know, and maybe there's plan A, plan B, plan C, plan whatever, but they're also with the idea of they could all go wrong. You know, what is it? There's, if plan A doesn't work, plan B, there's 26 letters in the alphabet, and, you know, and again.
And then you're not accounting for double letters.
And then exactly, and umlauts, and like all kinds, and numbers, then you go to the numbers, then there's an infinite number of numbers. But it's, you're right. It's, you know, you can only do so, you can only control the things that you can control. And that's very little in the world. And so you have to just be willing to say, okay, you know, that is what it is. And I can do what I can. And the rest is like, I'm just going to roll with it, because you can't, like, I can't control what somebody else does. I can't, like, I'm on the road. It's like, I can control my driving, but I can't control anyone else around me. That's like the story of life. So,
yep.
Did you figure out what you wrote down? Did you have the?
Cold email people.
Cold email people.
Yes, that's important. Like, especially when I was trying to figure out what grad program I wanted to do. I ended up emailing out to a few schools. I only visited one because by the people who replied, I figured out the one that I really liked. Saved a lot of money on applications, saved a lot of money on travel. So you never know what you'll get out of it. Same thing with jobs. Like, sometimes if a company isn't listing a job, but you really want to work for that company, just email someone in HR, see what you can do.
I found that one of the funniest bits of advice that someone ever gave me was ask people about themselves. Everybody wants to talk about themselves. Like, and it's amazingly true. Like, I have talked to people who I didn't know at all. And they were like high level in whatever field. Like, the number, everyone would be like, oh, you're not going to be able to get a hold of them at all. You won't be able to touch them. And I was like, okay, well, what are you going to lose by trying? Like, cold email. What can you lose? Except maybe they don't answer, but maybe they will. And when you ask them about themselves, like, talk about how they got to where they are. Talk about how, like, them. A lot of people were like, yeah, sure.
Like, the company I was working for before, I ended up meeting someone at, like, some volunteering thing who was close to a vice president. And we were, the vice president and I were both Miami grads. And she was like, oh, you should definitely email him. Just, like, talk about Miami. I was like, he's a vice president of this huge multi-million-dollar company. I don't know how I feel about that. That I did. And then he invited me down to headquarters to talk to him about Miami. So you never know what'll happen.
Right. And why not use common ground? I mean, it's a way to connect to someone, especially if it's a stranger. Like, it's something you already know you have in common. Why not? Right. What can you lose? So unless they hated Miami, in which case it might not be the best, but
I'm kidding. I don't think anyone who went to Miami really hates it.
That's good. That's awesome. That's very cool.
If they flaunt that they went to Miami, that means they really liked Miami.
Nice. Awesome. Well, oh my gosh, Hannah, thank you so much. I'm going to let you go because I know you probably have a ton of stuff to do. But I really appreciate yourself taking the time and chatting and talking about the stuff that you do. It's such cool work. You have to let me know how the fish goes. Remora for days. Remora robots. That's He's really so funny. Cool. All right. Awesome. Well, take care and we'll be in touch.
Okay.
Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in and joining us today with our guest, Hannah Arnholt, who's a pretty amazing person, and I cannot wait to hear what happens with the Remora robot fish. If you want to check out some of the websites that Hannah was talking about, check out the UNH Ocean Engineering site at marine.unh.edu, or the Society of Women Engineers, otherwise known as SWE, at swe.org, or you can build your own robot fish by going to instructables.com to the Robots Project. I'll be sure to include the links to all of these in the notes section of the podcast, as well as Hannah's LinkedIn and Instagram profiles. Thanks so much for tuning in and listening to Nature Knows, Conversations with Wild Warriors and Changemakers. We'll see you next time at lateshiftmedia.com. Have a good one.